on the front porch, we talk to poet Donald Hall.
Somewhere Freud says that the greatest happiness for an adult is the fulfillment of a dream begun in childhood. Doesn't sound like Freud, but he does say it. And I had that.
The New Hampshire writer and the former poet laureate for the state is a man with a strong sense of place. We'll talk about it tonight. Later in the show, we'll hear from Dave and Deb Nielsen, caretakers at the Old Man of the Mountain. For years, they've been working as volunteers to make sure New Hampshire's most visible symbol stays that way. I'm John Walters. Join us on the front porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. Donald Hall is one of New Hampshire's most renowned writers. He's a former poet laureate of the state, and he's published poems, essays, plays, and children's books, among other things. More than 25 years ago, he moved from Michigan to the old family home in Wilmot. Donald Hall has written extensively about the importance of that place and a sense of place. I asked him why he moved to the New Hampshire home.
The farm wasn't where I had lived entirely as a child. My grandmother was born there. My mother was born there. I was born in Connecticut. My mother went to Bates College in Maine, where she met this Connecticut man, who was my father. Then I spent all my summers up there. And I think when you talk to people about place a lot, many of them will talk about the summer place. That's one ingredient. It was a time of freedom from school. It was a time of freedom from parents and in the always sort of more forgiving or benign grandparents. It was a time for me when I wrote a lot of poetry, when I began to write poetry. But in my case, half of me came from there forever. The family, my great-grandfather, moved in there in 1865. And therefore, I developed early a kind of love for the place. Nobody ever threw anything away. My first prose book about New Hampshire is called String Too Short to Be Saved. Everything was kept, whether it's worthwhile or not. And I played among these things. I looked at the familiar things. I looked at the things that my great-grandfather had looked at and my grandmother. And I was also there part-time. So I was a suburban kid who picked the country and who was picked by it. And it was the mother's place, which is probably important. So I have a very strong sense of place. House and the mountain Kearsarge that we look at, Ragged Mountain, well, the farm is on the side of Ragged Mountain, really. The natural world, but then also the world of the house itself. When I moved there in 1975, I moved with my wife, Jane Kenyon, who came from Ann Arbor, Michigan. But she had grown up sort of in the countryside of Ann Arbor, opposite a working farm. And she loved it. And in fact, she encouraged me to give up tenure and, medical insurance and retirement and all that to do this. It was terrifying. And we made a living. I'm still making a living as a freelance writer, which not too many people do. But it was with her encouragement that we settled there permanently. And she developed a very strong sense of place in the 20 years that we lived together. Her poetry is absolutely full of it. So she was totally from another place, but adopted this one. It was very important to her.
I was going to ask, did moving back to New Hampshire turn out to be more or less than you expected? For her, it was more, I think.
For me, it was much, much more. I wanted to go there. When I was a kid, I wanted to be able to live there or nearby. I didn't want my grandparents to die. And that was required. But it was a dream. Somewhere Freud says that the greatest happiness for an adult is the fulfillment of a dream begun in childhood. Doesn't sound like Freud, but he does say it. And I had that. I thought also, mistakenly, that when I went back there, I would stop writing about it. I'd be right there. I'd write about other things. No way. I wrote a book of poems that came out in 1978. That was full of New Hampshire, and more prose books, Seasons at Eagle Pond, Here at Eagle Pond. Here at Eagle Pond was collected from magazine pieces that I did. I was full of it. I'm not writing about it so much now, but for many years I was.
A small place turns out to be a big inspiration, and maybe I would think, particularly for a poet, examining a limited amount of space would open up possibilities.
You know, in the particular place where we are, the solitude is important too. We could see one house from where we lived, so we bought it. And now my personal assistant lives there, which is very convenient. But Jane and I lived in a kind of double solitude. Jane died almost 6 years ago. And we didn't bug each other much, but we were very aware that the other was there. And people did not drive in the driveway to the or my cousins and so on, because they were thoughtful and they thought that they might interrupt work. We were both working in the house all day.
Is this something uniquely New Hampshire or New England, or is this something that is because it's the place that you're from?
I think that I've seen similar things in the rural South, and I haven't elsewhere. There may well be some instances, of course, but I think of the rural South and rural New England, northern Maine.
Can you define what that is about rural New England that makes it different?
One thing that makes a difference is the attitude toward eccentricity, to people being a little different. Around the university, you get a lot of praise and false praise. People would get a little drunk at a party, English professors, and say, how is our great poet today? You know, you want to slug him. And in rural New Hampshire, what I get from a lot of guys is, I can't see how you can sit still all day. These are guys who are pounding nails all day, you know.
Right, driving
changing
a truck.
Tires. Yeah. Uh-huh. And how can you sit still all day? It's very hard for me to pound a nail, in fact. And I feel that an attitude mostly is fellow over there carves peach pits into little skulls. Fellow over there writes poetry. Fellow over there, and so on. That I'm a sort of curiosity. And that's not condescended to, but it's accepted. And accepted like another human being. And I love that.
It's the Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters speaking with Donald Hall, poet, writer, and resident of Eagle Pond Farm in Wilmot. You often do readings in your home community and nearby, and you sort of make yourself not the famous writer who happens to live in a small town, but you try to make yourself part of that town as well.
Yeah, when I first came especially, my style changed enormously, and I knew that I was writing in a way for the neighbors, but more realistically, I was sort of writing out of the neighbors, as a kind of voice of the place. It really changed the way I sounded. And since then, I have changed again several times. You need to keep moving, or you'll die as a writer, I think. But that was important to me. I do love to read to the neighbors. I read, you know, coast to coast. Mm-hmm. It's part of the way I make my living. To read my poems aloud and answer questions and so on. But last summer I read up at the North Wilmot Church, and there were lots of people there, very familiar faces mostly, and that was fun, and that's all right.
Well, has it changed your poetry going from a place where you're in one of the academic centers of America to a rural community, a small community? Did it change your poetry to make it more, I don't know, approachable?
It did at first, yeah. And then somebody, after I've been doing this for maybe 5 years or so, somebody I respect and who lived in the country and had nothing against it, suggested that I was maybe limiting myself. I never thought of that. And I think I was. So I deliberately made myself more open to verse that was, or construction structures that were more modernist, and to being more eccentric in my language. And I think that was a good thing. My poetry is by and large quite accessible. It always has been. And I still write poems that, Marianne Moore used to say she wanted to write poems that cats and dogs could read. And she never did. But I think I do sometimes. And the subject matter, the tone of it, seems to call forth the kind of style you use. And there are some poems that I know are still relatively inaccessible, by which I mean the only people who are going to read it right away and with some pleasure are people who have spent a lot of time reading poetry, possibly writing it.
Most people today don't have any sort of a sense of place they're from, and I would include myself in that number. What are we missing?
Well, you're missing a great deal of pleasure, it seems to me. There is a negative side to it. I feel really bound to this place. And I think that after my wife died, I might well have tried another place. She's there very much, and I want her to be there. She's one of the things that ties me to it. She's part of the place. But I can't leave that house. I did go away one time for 3 months to New York and taught a class, and that was all right. But actually, during spring break, I went back for a week. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm tied. This is a little claustrophobic, but it's balanced by the fact that I love it, and I have so many strings attaching me to every corner of the house.
Well, New Hampshire is changing rapidly, not so much in your neck of the woods, although it's starting there. Is that a bad thing?
I thought that I would come back in 1975 to a totally altered culture, and I didn't. I came back to a culture very much like the one that I left, and I have seen it alter somewhat. When a town, people come to the country from the suburbs, they retire or they find a way somehow to eke out a living and come there. They do change the town. They come there because they love it. They're welcome people. But the culture that they come from, which is the culture that I come from, I know I'm not a New Hampshire man. I'm a sort of half New Hampshire man. And that allows me the perspective to write about it. I look at it, and it is special and it's different because it is not the city. It is not the suburbs. When the population of a town becomes 60%, people who came from Greenwich, Connecticut. They're people who love the country and celebrate it and start the historical society.
And the historic preservation movements.
Yeah, pay more attention in many ways to the history of the town. The culture changes. The old farm culture is still there, though very few people farm. I know that because some of my cousins would have a 40-hour a week job somewhere. And then they'd come home and raise a pig and have a big garden and do the things that their grandparents did.
In your ideal world, if there is such a thing, would people be more connected to a place of origin? Would there be less moving around?
I guess I have to say that. I've talked to people who say they feel a great freedom in the fact that they change houses every 2 or 3 years, and their fascination. Okay, fine. But I feel that what I am doing is preferable, more enjoyable. But how do I know? I have not moved very much. I went to college, went to Oxford, came back to the same college, then went out to Michigan, and I was there for 17 years in Ann Arbor. And now, 25 years, 26 years this year, in the grandparental farm.
More with Donald Hall in a moment. I'm John Walters. This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. Next time on The Front Porch, Phil Simmons, a writer and former English professor whose life changed 7 years ago when he learned he had a terminal illness. Now he's written a book about living and dying and taking the time to appreciate what you have. That's next time on The Front Porch on NHPR. It's The Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters, speaking with poet, writer, and Wilmot resident Donald Hall. What does it do to the structure of society, to our moral fiber, to be kind of a gypsy culture in a way?
I think it makes some chaos out of the system of values of what you care about, and destroys a sense of connection with the past. That's what I've got so much. I write children's books, I write short stories, I write poems. So many of them have to do somehow with a connection between the present and the past. All the children's books except one are trying to preserve something for kids who couldn't know anything about it. I didn't set out saying this is what I'm going to do, but it turned out to be, and I've noticed it more recently. I want people to connect with the past of their own country. And if they move from Dallas to Houston to Portland to Des Moines for a year or two each place, they learn a lot about geography and differences, but they don't, I shouldn't think, that they would be full of a sense of connection to American history, to the way people used to live.
Are you glad to be alive today, or would you be happier in an earlier time?
Insofar as I'm happy to be alive, I'm perfectly happy to be alive today. There are many things I'd like that my grandfather would have loved, like the Red Sox on television. I'm glad that my grandfather would have lived with many years more with modern medicine. Mm-hmm. He had a bad heart valve. They would have put in a new one. So there are many things I like about it. I also realize that living the way I do, emphasizing what I do, I am separating myself from the habits of the general public. I do travel. I grew up suburban. I see the suburban life a lot in my travels in particular. So I'm not totally separate, but I'm doing something that fewer and fewer people will be able to do. My children will never live at the farm, I don't think, any of them. I do have 5 grandchildren, and I would love it if one of them wanted to.
Well, if you'd been alive in, say, the 19th century or some earlier century, you may very well have been pounding nails instead of writing poems.
I do feel, in many ways, as if I did. I have had the experience of living in another century. When I came up in 1940, I came through Boston up on the Boston and Maine, little old crummy falling apart railroad car, and there were depots every 2 miles, because until very recently the farmers had used oxen to take their milk to the train in the morning, and my grandfather met me at the depot in a horse and buggy. To talk this way to young people or children now is obviously to be representative of something that might as well be the 18th century.
You mentioned some personal ambivalence about being alive today.
Oh, I've spent a lot of time depressed after the death of my wife.
Yeah. And I would think, I don't know, I would think the isolation of Eagle Pond might have contributed to that.
She's all over it. Mm-hmm. She's there. And I have, many people will understand this paradox, I have the experience again and again of feeling lonesome and very much wanting not to see anybody. That's the definition of a kind of depression, of course. But I'm not depressed all the time. And I've dated since Jane's death. And I have been writing quite a bit. I don't write quite so much as I did when Jane was alive, but lately I've had a thunderstorm of new poems, just a different style. Whenever in my life I have found a way to make a poem that is stylistically different from early ones, often in its sound, then poetry starts and a flood of poems start, and I don't need to do as many drafts on them before I finish them. I mean, typically my poems have gone, well, many have gone over 100 drafts. At this point, in this point of excitement, I may finish them in 20 or 30.
Only 20 or 30?
Yeah, I need to work a lot. I make mistakes. I'm not a quick study at all.
Well, you talked about feeling lonely but wanting to be alone.
Yeah.
I would think being in that house where the reminders of Jane would be both depressing and comforting at the same time.
Yep. I thought sometimes of trying to get a pied-à-terre in Boston or New York. I couldn't do it for a long time because of an old dog. The old dog received his lethal injection in June, and I could do it now. And I think of this occasionally. I could alter. I would see more people. I went down to Cambridge, stayed in a hotel for a week. I saw friends, but I said spend a certain amount of time hiding out in my room, wanting that solitude without people.
Given the difficulty of writing, maybe being in a place like Eagle Pond might be helpful in that it kind of forces you back to the table.
Oh, yeah. It's a happy habit. I mean, people, I remember at college reunions accusing me of self-discipline, and I indignantly refused that tribute. I write because I want to, and I like doing it. And there are no interruptions. The phone doesn't ring very often. If I went to the city permanently, I think that my habits of writing would have to change a great deal.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Donald Hall, poet, writer, former poet laureate of New Hampshire, and resident of Eagle Pond Farm in Wilmot, New Hampshire. This is The Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters. The Old Man of the Mountain is the most prominent symbol of New Hampshire. The rock formation in Franconia Notch is on our license plates, state road signs, the New Hampshire Quarter, not to mention countless souvenir items. But you may not know that while the Old Man is a natural formation, it would have fallen off the mountain long ago if not for the efforts of volunteers. They've been patching and shoring up the Old Man to counteract the effects of wind, weather, and gravity. David and Deb Nielsen lead the effort, which has been in Dave's family for about 40 years. Both have regular day jobs. Dave is chief of police in Belmont, and Deb is a security officer at the State House. Dave says although his father began caretaking in 1960, the effort to maintain the Old Man began in the early 1900s.
In 1905, a Reverend Guy Roberts, who was a Methodist minister from Whitefield, New Hampshire, noticed that the forehead stone had begun to slip forward. It took him 10 years to find somebody to fix that problem. He found an Ed Geddes who lived in Quincy, Massachusetts, and worked in granite quarries. They used a series of turnbuckles in the granite quarries to stop large rocks from falling. And that's the theory that he brought to the Old Man. They actually did that work in 1916.
Was the Old Man on public land then?
It was on private land. It was owned by one of the families that owned it was Greenleaf. And they owned a hotel at the base of the mountain. And it wasn't sold to the state of New Hampshire until the early 1940s.
Now, that one effort that started in 1905, how did it become a sort of a regular thing?
Didn't become a regular thing until after 1960. 1960 was my dad's first trip to the Old Man. His bridge crew sort of adopted the Old Man when the state of New Hampshire decided that perhaps there should be some regular inspections of the Old Man, who by that time was the emblem of the state of New Hampshire. And they felt that bridge crew people would be a good source to do that because they weren't afraid of heights. They began to do that and did it off and on for the first couple of years until they realized that it really should be a regular annual maintenance checkup for him, because 2 years could be enough so something could move or damage the Old Man. And that's what he began to do, is do some regular annual inspections.
So you got involved in it because you were Niles' son?
Yeah, my dad used to tell people that he went to the Old Man to give him a shave and a haircut. And at 11 years old, I couldn't quite figure out how you give a rock a shave and a haircut. So I had to go to the Old Man, and I had three older brothers, and each one of them had gone to the Old Man a couple of times. And virtually every year since then, since 1969, I've gone to the Old Man at least once a year.
So, Deb, when you met David, did you know about all this?
Actually, we met through police work, and when he told me who he was, I didn't believe him. And I thought, oh, that's a good pickup line. And our second date was on top of the Old Man on the mountain.
Doing maintenance work?
No, actually, it was one of their trips up, and I tagged along.
Well, let's talk about what you do to preserve the old man.
We go up every year. We usually go up in late May, early June to see how he wintered. That allows us to eyeball the situation and see if there's any obvious damage over the winter or any obvious vandalism that occurred in the previous year.
Vandalism.
Vandalism. We have a large problem with vandalism to the old man. The old man is owned by the state of New Hampshire. The trail goes directly to the old man, hiking trail. So we get a lot of day trippers that come to the old man, and unfortunately, people find it necessary to carve their name in something or spray paint something or chip a piece of the old man off and take it home with them. So we have to deal with that every year. And then we plan, from that first trip in May, we plan how many days' worth of actual work we need to do. And usually that's done in late July or early August. And that can be, now that can be anyways from a day to 2 days or 3 days. Years ago, 20 years ago, we used to hike up and down the mountain, and it would take us 5 or 6 days to do the work. Now we use a helicopter that flies us up and down the mountain, and we can do it in a day and a half or 2 days sometimes.
I got the chance to see you at work last summer, and you're actually like on a mountaineering gear hanging off the face of the mountain. How does that feel?
Actually, you don't think about it.
I mean, you don't look down.
I don't look down. I've looked down. The first time I did, I had to look down. I mean, it was like, this is awesome. Yeah.
How far down is it?
Over the south face, it's about 100 feet to the ground, and over the front of his face, it's about 1,000 feet to the ground.
When you're down on the face, what are you doing?
On the south side, you've got cracks that you fill epoxy. You have to use the epoxy. On the front side, we have the checkpoints where we measure those. We did a couple years ago, we went down to the Keystone where we had to epoxy a crack that was way down. We call it the Adam's apple. You have to nickname everything.
I don't think you probably ever expected that you'd be doing something like this with your life.
No. I've always wanted to, and I told my grandfather one time that, yes, I would climb up there. Unfortunately, he did not live long enough to see me do it. My grandmother did. But it was a curiosity thing, you know. Geez, this looks like an old man. I wonder what's really up there. And I had the opportunity to do it.
And not only climb up, but hang off.
And give him a kiss every once in a while.
All right, well, thanks very much for coming in today.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
David and Deb Nielsen, the keepers of the Old Man of the Mountain. Fears are falling down on me, heavy things I could not see. The Front Porch is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. You can listen to The Front Porch anytime at our website, nhpr.org. And if you have feedback or show ideas, email us at frontporch@nhpr.org. The producer of The Front Porch is Nathan Irwin, executive producer Laura Colbert. I'm John Walters. Join us again next time on The Front Porch.